I don't think I recovered yet. The O2 was electric when Susanita Ubanez won. The contract broken. Marie Van Claudio free. It felt like the perfect cathartic feel-good moment. And then that first German suplex hit, and you realize the entire story was a lie. Susanita had been played like a fiddle from the very beginning.
It was chilling, John. It was a masterclass in deception. We thought we were watching a rescue story, but we were actually watching a coronation. Marie wasn't the victim, she was the architect. She used Susanita's earnest, heartfelt crusade as a stepping stone to reveal her true power. And the visual of it, Valkyrie, Knox, and Amy Harrison, the supposed captors, kneeling behind her, that wasn't a team formation. That was a total inversion of power, a hostile takeover hidden in plain sight.
It's the kneeling that gets me. For months, we're told Marie is property. She's being forced to stand at ringside, her eyes downcast. We get the free Marie chance. The whole story is built on our empathy for her. Then to find out she was the one pulling the strings all along, I mean, does that kind of subversion risk exhausting the fans? Do you feel cheated or just genuinely shocked?
I think it elevates Marie to a level of villainy UTA hasn't seen in years. It's one thing to be a dominant champion. It's another thing entirely to weaponize the audience's compassion against them. Think about the data here, the actual result. Susanita fought a high-stakes match, won, and was rewarded with 3 German suplexes and public humiliation. She broke a contract that Marie, as the true leader, likely drafted herself. This wasn't a wrestling angle, John. This was a multi-week psychological operation.
So what does that say about a character like Susanita? She fought with honor, she fought for her friend, and she got absolutely destroyed for it. Is there still room for that kind of earnest, virtuous hero in a world where empires are built on lies?
That's the question the show leaves us with. Susanita didn't lose a match. She lost her belief that goodness is a shield. Meanwhile, Marie proved that a crown is heaviest and most powerful when it's hidden in plain sight. And honestly, that dark, deceptive tone set the stage for a night that would only get more brutal as the veterans stepped into the ring.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Gunnar Van Patten. He came out to American Badass, his first ever theme music. He shed the mercenary gear for his old 90s trunks and face paint. It felt like he was going back to the beginning to face the end. It was beautiful. And then Hakuryu just took him apart.
That entrance was everything. It wasn't just nostalgia. It was a statement. GVP's whole philosophy was on display. He knew he wasn't the man he once was. He said it himself. 20 years of paid receipts in that body. He was facing a tornado tag match where he was outnumbered 2-5 before Lindsay Lothario even showed up. But he believed if he could find that one honest night, that one moment where he was as good once as he ever was, it would be enough.
But it wasn't enough. I mean, the brutality of those final moments. Hakuryu with the Bakken, my God.
The Bokken strikes were agonizing. But the key moment for me wasn't the violence itself. It was Hakuryu's scream. Hakuryu, the white dragon, the man who has a prayer for every outcome, who enters every exchange with the same calm, meditative focus. He hit GVP with that Bokken 7 times, and Gunnar kept getting up. And on that 8th strike, Hakuryu just screamed, a raw, guttural sound of pure frustration. It was the first time we've seen a crack in that serene, dominant facade.
Right. And the weapon broke. The Bakken literally snapped in half on GVP's back before the man himself did.
Exactly. So who really won that exchange? Hakuryu retained his title. Yes. He rendered GVP unconscious with a splintered piece of wood jammed against his throat. But he was so rattled by GVP's refusal to stay down that he had to abandon his entire philosophy of detached violence just to get the job done. GVP went out on his own terms, leaving nothing but his gloves and a reminder that while you can break a man's body, you can't retire his ghost.
It felt less like a wrestling match and more like the demolition of a historic building. And from that demolition, we go straight into the All or Nothing Rumble, which had its own insane architecture. The rules were a mess of high stakes. I'm still trying to process it. Emily Hightower walked in as a contender and walked out as both the women's champion and the hardcore champion. That is an insane haul for one night.
And it's all because of the rules. The all or nothing format turned this from a simple survival race into a strategic math problem. Emily outlasted the 10 other women in the field, making her the new women's champion while she was still an active competitor. But then, by being eliminated in sixth place overall, she was times awarded the hardcore championship. It perfectly illustrates Maxwell Jett's backstage critique of the format. He called it organized theft and a way for people to fail upward. Emily got eliminated and won a second title.
And it wasn't just her. What about Silas Grimm and El Fantasma Oscuro One? They weren't even a team and they walked out as tag team champions. How does that even work?
That's the other wrinkle. The rule stated the first two eliminated from the final eight become the new tag team champions. Silas and El Fantasma got tossed out at eighth and seventh place, respectively, at almost the same time. So, boom, a marriage of convenience, as the blueprint put it, between two supernatural dark forces who now hold the tag titles. It completely upends the tag division. Does it make it stronger? Or does it just reward two guys for failing together at the 90-minute mark?
So the floor was basically a vault. If you hit it at the right time, you still left with gold. It's crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. And it all led to one of the most absurd final two pairings I think I've ever seen.
Let's get to it. The final two, Maxwell Jett and Bobby Dean, a guy who spent the entire match crawling under the ropes and a guy who spent most of it sitting in a mobility scooter eating crisps. On paper, it sounds like a joke. But those last 5 minutes, that was very real.
That's because Bobby Dean finally woke up. For 50-plus entrants, his battle chair strategy was a masterclass in non-engagement. He was, as I think he put it, optimizing his energy. And it worked! He made it to the end. But it was Chris Ross who ended that strategy by physically dragging him out of the chair and forcing him into the ring. And from that moment, everything changed.
Especially once Bobby realized Jett was the one who laughed when he lost his chair. You could see the switch flip. But Jett, my God, how did he even survive that long?
By perfecting the art of weaponized cowardice. Maxwell Jett understands something most wrestlers don't. Survival isn't pretty. It's, in his words, ugly and expensive. He survived Shawn Jackson, Chris Ross, and Mikey Unlikely by using other people as strategic shields. He was constantly crawling under Yoshi's legs, hiding behind Bobby Dean. He turned every collision into an escape route.
Until the very end, that final betrayal, biting Bobby's hand, kicking the battle chair away when Bobby was hanging on for dear life. It was just peak Jett.
It was the most Maxwell Jett thing he's ever done. Because you don't have to be the best fighter to be the best survivor. You just have to be willing to bite the hand that isn't even trying to feed you. Jett didn't win through strength. He won by exploiting the one thing his opponents couldn't ignore: their own humanity, their own history, their own grudges.
So when we look back at this whole night, what's the big picture? What's the core story International Fair told us?
I think there are three big takeaways. First, the illusion of freedom. The entire women's division was reset by a massive lie. Marie Van Claudio proved that presenting yourself as a victim is the ultimate strategic cover, and she was willing to destroy the division's trust to build her empire.
And it felt like that theme carried over to the men's side, too. This idea that old virtues are now liabilities.
Exactly. That's the second point. Resilience has become a target. Look at Gunnar Van Patten. He was a pillar of toughness, but Hakuryu dismantled him with cold, clinical efficiency. Look at Xavier Hawkins, whose high emotional investment in his ankle injury was a weakness. Graham Keel kept poking. In this new UTA, it seems like toughness is being replaced by efficiency.
Which brings us to the man who walked out with the biggest prize.
The coward's efficiency. Maxwell Jett's retention of the UTA championship proves that in a chaotic 70-person war, traditional warrior traits are less effective than opportunistic self-preservation. He didn't win the fight. He survived the room.
We like to believe that in a 70-person war, the strongest or the most courageous soul eventually rises to the top. But International Fair 2026 left us with a bitter alternative. The winners weren't the ones who bled the most or fought the hardest. They were the ones who lied best, analyzed coldest, and cheated fastest. As Maxwell Jett stands alone in the corner of that ring clutching his title, we have to ask ourselves, are we angry because he cheated? Or are we angry because he showed us that in a world of absolute chaos, the most honest person in the building is usually the first one over the top rope? Maybe the battle chair wasn't a joke. Maybe it was the only sane response to a match designed to break everyone who dared to stand up.